to tighten laws on foreign donations to political parties and to simplify voter registration. This follows several other nations, including Austria, Malta, Brazil, and Indonesia. The plan was not a surprise, as the center-left Labour Party has backed votes for 16-year-olds for some time now. And the idea was a main part of the official platform that allowed it to win last year's general election. The plan requires a law, which requires it moving through both houses of parliament, with the change in some time, changes some time away. The Labour Party has a large majority in the House of Commons, and the next general election isn't expected until 2029.
Mother turns her grief into a lifelong for others. Tragedy led mother of an environmental activist to launch the Resilient Activist, a nonprofit. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sammy Aaron of Kansas City, Missouri, wants to make sure that environmental activists who take care of the planet also take care of themselves. In 2003, she lost her son Kevin to suicide.
He actually wrote in one of his journals, "I know all about sustainability, but I don't know how to sustain myself."
After her tragic loss, Aaron wanted to ensure that other activists have resources and support to prioritize their own mental and emotional well-being. So she founded the Resilient Activist, a nonprofit that hosts in-person and online events.
We've got workshops that help activists reevaluate when they are close to overwhelm and burnout. And we have monthly climate cafes where people can share what's on their hearts.
She says it's important for activists to make time for self-care because too often they put their own needs on the back burner.
There's this sense that I don't need to take time or energy to get help because there's too much to do.
But she says it's critical to talk about your feelings with people who understand and seek the help of a professional if you're distressed. If you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Thanks for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Chittenden, Hannah Francis, and James Kemp. The producer is David Crittenden, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Farah Siddiqui. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to KBOO or kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I have here with me Adriana Adami, who is an underscore Native News 2025 fellow. Adami is a journalist of Mexican and Chippewa Cree heritage, passionate about telling stories from diverse communities. Though she grew up in Southern California, her reporting journey has taken her across the East Coast and Midwest. Her career has included covering Indigenous democracy, as a reporter for Buffalo's Fire in North Dakota, and writing features at Syracuse.com. Hello, Adriana. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So first, will you tell me a little bit about what has brought you here to work with Underscore?
For sure. So I came from North Dakota out here, and I pretty much saw, you know, while in North Dakota, that there was a position open for the summer fellow at Underscore Native News. And I had left my previous job, and I was looking for, you know, what was next? Like, where do I want to go? I knew I still wanted to report on Indigenous communities. This has kind of been my jam for the last few years. And so when I saw that this fellowship with a newsroom I was very familiar with and admired very much, I knew the reporters and really had thought about living in the Pacific Northwest before, even if it was just temporary. I applied for the position. I wasn't too sure if I was going to get or not. I know there's been lots of talented reporters who have completed the fellowship before, but luckily I was the recipient for 2025 and I was able to come out here for the summer.
So I'm hoping to talk to you about two of your articles. The first one is We Are the Treaty. Umatilla tribes commemorate the 170th anniversary of the Walla Walla Treaty of 1855. The Confederate tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation celebrated Treaty Day on Friday, June 13th, hosting the first annual celebration since 2023. So first of all, will you tell me a little bit about what Treaty Day is, and then what it was like?
Mm-hmm. So the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation had their Treaty Day a few days later than usual, I believe. Their Treaty Day is on June 9th. Please correct me if I am wrong. But they had their Treaty Day a few days later, and it pretty much acknowledges the Umatilla, the Cayuse, and the Walla Walla, who are the three tribes who reside on that reservation. And, you know, the Treaty of 1855, they signed with the United States, which pretty much designated the Umatilla Indian Reservation to the three of them. And the event itself, it was very lively. People were really happy to be there. I showed up quite a bit beforehand. I saw horses everywhere, decorated with little bells on them. And then the event started with a parade around the 9 o'clock hour. So many cool things to look at that parade. There were, you know, first responders as well as other organization and vehicles with decor on them. There, you know, were tribal citizens riding horses, some of them wearing regalia, the low jingling of the bells going by. And then, you know, there's the CTUIR, they're the youth council, and, you know, they're holding pictures and flyers of important environmental topics such as the salmon. And I mean, there were children and parents as well as other people lined up along the street. And, you know, the folks in the parade were, you know, throwing candy out to them. So whenever a float came by, there'd be children scrambling to get that latest batch of candy.
That sounds really sweet. Who are some of the organizers of this celebration?
Mm-hmm. So this was held by the tribe. So there was the tribe. It was some first responders. They also had a special veterans service. So I believe a department that handles, you know, veteran affairs helped lead that. And then, of course, you had the youth council. So pretty much everyone in the parade, you know, helped organize it in a way. But yeah, it started as that, turned into a veterans ceremony. And then there was an actual event where they had some speeches from some tribal citizens as well as the council in the longhouse. And then you had some other folks who were invited to booth and talk about first foods and other topics, since, you know, there was pretty good turnout.
Nice, yeah. What is some of the intention behind commemorating this day?
Mm-hmm. So the big message from this event was to acknowledge and celebrate Treaty Day, to make sure that, you know, the United States is still held accountable for maintaining those treaties, and to remind people that, you know, they do have treaty rights, and to not back down when, you know, they need to fight for certain things, whether it's environmental, educational, etc. But it was very much lands right focused.
Thanks. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this article and this experience?
So, yeah, I guess, you know, just to do some shout outs to the parade marshal, Janine Gordon. She works at, what is it called? Whitman College. There we go. Yeah, Janine Gordon. She was a parade marshal, and she also works at Whitman College. She gave a lot of insight during her speech about, you know, what it means to be a tribal citizen at the Confederated Tribes, as well as, you know, why it's important for the youth, you know, to learn this history. And a lot of youth nowadays are very interested and hands-on, and they want to carry on traditions moving forward, which, you know, was a concern generations ago. But it is definitely becoming, youth are becoming a lot more involved, and, you know, elders are relieved but also happy to see that traditions will carry on, you know, seven generations down.
Absolutely. Thanks. So the second article that I wanted to talk to you about is a new book about the effects of climate change on first foods from Umatilla tribes. The Confederated Tribes of Umatilla's First Foods Policy Program opens up discussion on food sustainability with the release of the Gatherers Project. So will you tell me a little bit more about the Gatherers Project?
Mm-hmm. So the Gatherers Project, it's a book kind of just about first foods gatherers at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. The book starts with, you know, elders, and then it each page kind of goes down. So you'll start with the, you know, oldest elder, and then you'll go down to the youngest gatherer. And it kind of is informative about, you know, climate change, the environmental impacts, as well as why land rights are important for first foods. So the first foods kind of starts with water. And if I am correct, it progresses to salmon or lamprey or other types of fish, as well as meat. And then it'll go from roots to berries, then back to water, and the cycle begins again.
Wow, that's really interesting.
A lot of the book, you know, talks about, so kind of just how gatherers, they tend to gather roots and berries. And it talks about how, you know, this is a tradition that has been around since time immemorial. But, you know, when the Treaty of 1855, the Walla Walla Treaty of 1855 was signed, they, like those who were not of Umatilla, were moved onto the Umatilla Indian Reservation. So there's an effect of how much area there was to cover for gathering, but then there is also climate change concerns. It's getting hotter. I remember during one of the interviews, I was told that sometimes it could get a little bit dangerous, that, you know, they were seeing rattlesnakes out a lot sooner just with how hot it was. And, you know, that's something they want to avoid, so that, you know, no one gets hurt while gathering. And as well as how the younger gatherers are often trained by elders in the community. So you'll have mothers, you know, will have trust the women in their community to teach these traditions to their daughters. And so this isn't just about gathering or learning tradition, but this is about learning history, as well as, you know, how, like, what steps to take, you know, to protect the environment and their land, as well as, you know, how to stay safe while gathering.
Yeah, thanks for that context. What is the hope for this book in the community?
Mm-hmm. I talked to Colleen Sanders, who helped, you know, write the proposal to get this book project funded. And she, as well as Althea Wolf, told me that their goal was to educate the community, particular younger folks. Their goal is, so there's 500 copies of the book available, and their goal is to make the copies free and then place them in, you know, school libraries, tribal schools, public schools, as well as, you know, other spaces where youth will be able to access them to learn more about the gathering process. So they just want to make it accessible and available and free. So yeah, it's mostly to educate youth, but also maybe for those who didn't get to, you know, experience the culture while growing up, this is also a good way to reconnect, because, you know, not everyone gets the chance to, you know, learn about their tribe's history, and this kind of helps give, you know, some context And I myself had never learned about gathering prior to reporting on this. So this was also an educational opportunity for me as well.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Sure. I believe for those who are interested in receiving a free copy of the Gatherers Project book, you can reach out to Colleen Sanders at Colleen, C-O-L-L-E-E-N, Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, at C-T-U-I-R.org. They are trying to get them in, public libraries. If there are, any other resources that could benefit from having a copy of this book, that's a great resource to have out there as well.
Can this book also be purchased?
It can't be purchased, but also you could get it as a PDF online on the First Foods website at CTUIR website.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It was really nice to talk to you, Adriana.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you as well. I'm glad that we met.
Adriana Dami.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in depth. I'm Hannah Francis.
Today I'm joined by the executive director of the Oregon Arts Watch to talk about some of their latest published articles. Hi, Laura.
Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I always like to be here.
Love to have you. So let's talk about these first two articles that sort of go in tandem with each other. The first is C.S. Price, A Portrait. Roger Sadak's book is a thorough and precise chronicle of the modernist Oregon painter. And then that sort of goes along with the other article, which is about the showcase that goes along with the book. Is that right?
Yeah, there's an exhibit, and then there's a book that goes with the exhibit. So we have these two stories about C.S. Price. One the exhibit and one the accompanying book. And both the stories are by David Bates. So I'm just going to talk about both of them, just combine the information in a way. C.S. Price was one of Oregon's most influential modernist painters who emerged during the first half of the 20th century. And a retrospective of his work is on view at the Hallie Ford Museum of Art in Salem, which is affiliated with Willamette University. The story has lots of lovely little heartwarming details. Roger Sadak, who wrote the accompanying book that goes with the exhibit, Roger Sadak is a retired attorney in Eugene, and he fell in love with C.S. Price's work when he was 12, when his dad took him to a museum. And after that, it became this all-consuming passion project for him for the next 60-plus years. So when he was 12, he encountered one of Price's late paintings called The Fisherman. And in Sadak's words, it wasn't trying to show me something or tell me something. I had the impression that it was asking me a question. I never had that reaction to a painting before. So, and then he spent, the past six decades tracking down and learning about all he could about C.S. Price's artwork. So C.S. Price lived from 1874 to 1950. He was born in Iowa into a very large homesteader family. He was one of like 12 children. And he grew up on farms and ranches that were very remote and miles from anything. So he wasn't exposed to other contemporary art, except maybe black and white images in magazines. And a lot of his early work of paintings was just what he saw around him. It was horses and cattle and coyotes. Later in adulthood, in his 30s and 40s, he managed to get to cities where he could view contemporary art. And then his artwork, as Sadak describes, makes a quote, like a transition and observation to imagination. which means it became less rooted in trying to recreate a realistic likeness, and it became more and more abstract. So this would have been the 20s and the 30s for this time period. And in Oregon, this was artwork that was really different. It was challenging. He was really a modernist that for our region was a really ahead of his time. So the book describes Price's art practice as a spiritual journey. He lived very frugally in a small studio apartment in downtown Portland. He never married. He was a very quiet person and kept to himself. And so the description to me sounds really like a monk. He believed in an interconnectedness of all things, a commonality, what he called the one big thing, which is something that he was always striving to portray in his paintings. So there are 40 paintings in the exhibit that span the whole spectrum of his artistic life. The exhibit C.S. Price, A Portrait, is on view at the Halle Ford Museum in Salem through August 30th.
It sounds really fascinating.
I was fascinated to read about it. I was aware of his name, but not aware of the whole backstory. So I was actually really curious to read more about him and learn about the whole, you know, just that. And there's very little to work with because he led such a frugal life. There's not a lot of documentation on him. So Sadak really had to dig for information. So it's really an accomplishment to bring all this information together and all of these artworks together in one place. It's a really sort of a monumental exhibit and book.
Definitely makes me want to go see it.
Yeah, me too.
So then we've got another article on a horror book, which is called Girl in the Creek, Oh the Horror. Oregon author and editor Wendy N. Wagner talks with Bobby Bermia about her novel, a true crime / climate horror phantasmagoria that the Library Journal calls a tightly written masterclass in horror. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that word and I did not, because I would have definitely have stumbled over it. I am not a horror person. I don't like to be scared, but the story kind of was quite charming to me, actually. Bobby Bermia, who wrote the story, is a huge horror fan. He loves Halloween. He loves nothing more than a good scare. So he was sort of the perfect person to talk to Wendy N. Wagner about her new novel, which just came out July 15th. So the novel has had lots of great reviews. She's an Oregon native. She hails from the small town of Ash Valley, which has a population of like 62 people. It's very remote. And when she was growing up, there wasn't even much of a television signal and there weren't a lot of kids her age. So as a kid, she waited for the bookmobile to come out every 2 weeks. And so I love the detail that the story has, where one time she checked out every Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys book, which numbered like 125 books, and she read all of them in 2 weeks, which I can't even imagine doing. But I love all that, and I love how she talks about discovering scary books when she was really young. So they felt like forbidden territory, like books that she shouldn't be reading yet, but they obviously really sparked her imagination. The publisher Tor Nightfire describes a book as, quote, a tense cli-fi, which I believe is climate fiction, cosmic horror novel set in a rural Oregon forest that seems to consume any who enter. So Wagner talks about how her book is a way to work through her fears and trauma and turn it into something positive, which I thought was just a sort of a nice lesson in a way. And she is quoted as saying, horror started out as this exercise of, can I make myself braver? Then it became a tool in my life for dealing with fear. I like to think that I can take the things that have been hurtful and scary that I've experienced, and I can turn it into something nourishing. It can be a healthy meal for somebody else's soul.
Last but not least at all, is this article, 50 Years of Quilting, Sisters Outdoor Quilt Show, celebrates its golden anniversary. Gene Wells started the show in 1975 with a handful of quilts hung outside her Stitch and Post quilt shop. And this year's show, on July 12th, is expected to draw more than 10,000 visitors. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, you have the details there. I was fascinated to learn about this too. And like you mentioned, the quilt show was started in 1975 by Gene Wells. And so this was its 50th anniversary. The quilt show happened over July 12th. And really, it draws thousands of people. So what I love, like you mentioned, that it started in 1975 with just a few quilts outside a quilt shop, it has grown into the largest outdoor quilt show in the world. And it just grew organically over the years. The entire town becomes a gallery with hundreds of quilts strewn over everything. And there's no judging and no admission fee. So I like how the story explains how people of any skill level can show their work without any judging. It's a celebration of the act of creativity. I will say, too, that whenever we publish a story about quilts, it goes nuts, just nuts. And I think that really speaks to how quilts embody a whole lot of things, and they really speak to people. So there's the frugalness of using scraps of fabric and being resourceful and not wasteful. There's the long history that centers people and family. They often document family history. There's that intersection of utilitarian purpose and craft and beauty and fine art. And quilts were used in the Underground Railroad to secretly communicate. They incorporated information, signals, and maps. And then, of course, there's that sense of warmth and comfort that they evoke. So the quilts embody a lot of things that really appeal to people, I think.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.